Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? All right, great. So I think we should start because it's the appointed time and there's a lot of material. So my name is Joel Wiesen. I've had some 50 years of experience in employee selection and testing, 15 years with the state of Massachusetts and the Civil Service Agency, 35 years as a private consultant, and I consider myself a scientist practitioner. And this presentation builds on my expert witness work on many employment discrimination court cases, where I looked very closely at what was done, and I noticed even large, prominent consulting firms and test development groups were making assumptions that didn't seem to be founded. So I think these weaknesses might put a ceiling on validity, might explain the ceiling on validity that we see, suggest some better practices. I'll start out with a brief historical perspective, and then we'll go over 17 flawed or weak assumptions. The references didn't fit on the slides, but the references are on my website, and that URL is also shown in the last poll question on HUVA. Okay, historical perspective. The weaknesses and flaws in testing are not new, and we'll look now at perhaps the worst. It concerns the eugenics movement. It was a prominent movement back in the early 1900s. It was supported by leading psychologists. It found that Jews and Italians were of low intelligence. And so Goddard reported research findings that 10% of Jews and 7% of Italians were in the normal range of intelligence, and 76 and 79% were in the moron range, IQ between 50 and 70. And eugenics was a heavy-duty mistake supported by psychologists. These findings had a profound legal impact. They led to restrictive immigration laws, kept out people from Italy, from Eastern Europe, and various nasty state laws. And the eugenics movement was supported by leading psychologists. These names may be familiar to you. They're heavy hitters in the history of psychology, including Edward Thorndike, the father of R.L. Thorndike. Edward was the first president of the American Psychological Association. There was an obvious flaw in the research. They used English language IQ tests with recent immigrants to the country with limited English language facility. In retrospect, we say, how in the world could these superstars be so oblivious to this flaw? Perhaps they were racist and reflecting the social viewpoints of the time. Many in the US did not want immigration of Catholics from Italy and Jews from Eastern Europe, who they viewed as too different from them. Perhaps the psychologists were not surprised by their findings, and so they didn't look very carefully at the methodology. That's a major pitfall, and perhaps we do that again today. I think we should learn from this past experience. If you think that major mistakes can't happen to us today, reflect on the status of the validity of general mental ability. Until just a few years ago, we thought that it was the be-all and end-all of what you needed to look at in employee selection with a validity of 0.51, based on Schmidt and Hunter's 1998 article. And then Sackett came along and said, no, it's really 0.31, and it's not the highest. So in part two, we'll look at 17 different flawed assumptions, and we'll do it by looking at five facets. We'll look at the assumption, some of the issues. We'll discuss some of the issues. I'll suggest some of the research needed and suggest some immediate actions. We'll cover this this quickly. One of the reviewers said I should focus on fewer subjects, but at my age, I don't know if I have another conference in me at which to present. Some of the slide headings are cryptic because I couldn't fit everything on one line. So for example, I couldn't fit the word misconceptions on this slide. I also abandoned bullets to save space. Okay, the first topic considers why multiple choice test grades are based on the number correct. And the assumption seems to be that strengths compensate for weaknesses, and all items equally predict overall ability. And maybe there's a third assumption, it's good enough, and more about that later. A couple of the issues are, you can pass people despite failing crucial areas, and we don't ask SMEs about the weights for test items. Item weights are not part of the ANGOV pass point process. There's a 2020 article that talks about the theory of using the underlying total score. It's listed in the references on my website. Lacking a crucial KSAP can result in a serious job failure. Should these takers pass? An EMT aces anatomy but fails CPR. A nurse aces drugs but fails equipment. Why should we hire people with known serious deficiencies in critical KSAPs? So I tried to look up in the literature why we don't use multiple hurdles, and found in Guyon's 2011 textbook these two reasons. They result in high overall failure rate, and there's a high false negative rate due to error. I don't find these arguments very persuasive. Guyon seems to say that we should be passing people who we know are incompetent in order to have an acceptable passing rate. So the first suggestion is that we develop a methodology to rate KSAPs to see which ones are compensatory or fungible, which are interchangeable. We don't do that yet. And the second suggestion is to take a look at the data from our past exams and see, how often does this actually happen? How often does somebody who scores really well basically show us they have serious weaknesses? In terms of immediate action, I think passing scores should be set for all crucial KSAPs to avoid negligent hiring. And I've already mentioned the job analysis not yet looks at compensatory and non-compensatory KSAPs should be modified to do that. And that'll come up again later in our presentation. Okay, topic two. Topic two is that involves equating using Z-scores. And we'll look at two ways Z-score equating is used: to equate raters or rating panels, or to combine scores on unlike scales, such as two test scores. And example one involves raters or panels of raters, and the situation comes up frequently. You have two panels, they have different means or standard deviations. And example two, we're just combining two tests that have different two different KSAPs, and they have different means and standard deviations. So let's talk about going to issue one a little bit. Let's assume that the means of two rater panels are statistically significantly different. Should we equate? Well, let's ask, what would happen if one group had some superstars? After the equating using Z-scores, the superstars get lower scores. Good applicants graded with superstars suffer, and poor applicants graded with turkeys benefit. Those, I think, are some unintended consequences of standardizing. We distort the scores of all candidates in order to try to fix the problem. And we'll look at this numerically in a moment. And we treat the differences between panels as due to rater error, but it could be that the two groups are really different, and we might be equating two unequal groups. And with respect to combining scales, when we use these scores, we lose all information about the scale score meaning. But we might have some insight into the scale score meaning. So for example, let's say that you're combining physical ability test scores with a test of general mental ability, perhaps for a job like firefighter. And we might understand that a 1 second difference in the physical ability test isn't a very important difference, but when we standardize, that might not be true. And it could be that equating standard deviations will magnify trivial differences. There's another danger. If we had several, say four tests of four different KSAPs, and candidates do very poorly on three of them and well on one of them, it could be the candidate scores higher overall, scored very, very poorly on three of the KSIPs, and the highest scoring total, the highest scoring candidate on the overall isn't a very good candidate. So let's discuss that a little bit. Example one, if you start out with a group of 15 candidates that are normally distributed and you add in a superstar, five standard deviations above the mean or something, well, after you standardize, that superstar is no longer a superstar. The superstar now maybe has a Z of 3, and the top score that had been the top score, that maybe had a Z of 2 or so, now only has a Z of 1 or so. So this is the first of two sequential steps in the Z-score equating. First, we standardize within, and then we combine the scores. Now, when you consider combining the scores, since your superstar has disappeared, when you combine the scores from the two panels, somebody who is just good on one panel is as good as the superstar on the first panel. So the superstar loses out to a non-superstar, and it's serious to miss a true superstar. And the applicant scores are no longer independent of each other when we standardize. The issue is, should we trust a really high score given by one panel? And with respect to combining scale scores, as I said, we lose all meaning when we equate. So for example, consider two scales. One that has the highest score is 100% correct, and the other one, the highest score is near chance. Well, we know something about those scores, but when we equate, what we know is disappears. So we need to think more about rate of differences, their causes, and what to do about them. We need some criteria to use to decide when to equate. We need better ways to equate raters. We need better ways to train raters so we believe them instead of just assuming that the difference between groups is something we have to correct for. And with respect to combining two scale scores, we have to think about how we can preserve what we know about high and low scores when we do that combination. With respect to what we could do immediately, we could have all raters grade a subgroup of the applicants and equate based on those grades, or we could have everybody graded by two panels. The reference list on the website has a publication that talks about how you can measure the size of rate of differences and deal with them. With respect to these combining tests on two different KSAPs, we could use some scale anchors such as minimally acceptable to help us equate the scores. Okay, topic three, 100 items are sufficient. Often we find exams with 100 items, especially on civil service examinations, and this makes sense only if we have these two assumptions, that 100 items give us good reliability and 100 items allows for good coverage. But whenever there are more than a handful of KSAPs, the number of items per KSAP could be small. So if you have 30 KSAPs and 100 items, that's an average of three items per KSAP. If you had a really important KSAP and you gave it 20 items, what does that leave for the other KSAPs? And I've seen test outlines with 1, 2, and 3 items per KSAP. Having only a few items raises two main issues, the reliability of measurement. That's the danger of using too few items is the low reliability and the high error score. And an issue are we covering the domain? What's the content coverage? So if you have a test of, for example, inferential statistics, can you cover that topic with 3 items? So I think, again, we could look retrospectively. We could say, what has been the reliability of past tests concerning each KSAP? And we could calculate the passing rate with multiple hurdles and see if it's really a problem, and if so, how big a problem? and suggestions for immediate action, we should reliably measure each critical KSAP. I think that's intuitively logical, should be easily adopted. And we should use enough items so that we think we have reasonably sampled the knowledge domain. Okay, topic four. So in many tests, the number of items is a function of the importance rating of the KSAP. Well, this has some presumptions, and that is that that's a reasonable way of weighting, and that the number of items should reflect the importance. So the question is not whether the weighting by number of items works at all, but whether it's the most valid approach. As in the previous topic, there are a couple of issues. One is some KSAPs will have very few items. There's low reliability with few items. And with respect to content coverage, if you rate KSAPs by importance, and you have two KSAPs that are equally important, then we get an equal number of questions, but some KSAPs cover a broad topic and some a narrow topic, and you have the same number of questions for the broad and narrow topic. I was involved in a court case, and there was a 600-page book on police administration on a promotional examination for sergeant, and the exam had one question on that 600-page book. The court was appalled that there was only one question on that 600-page book, but maybe some surprisingly, turns out candidates didn't bother reading the book because they knew from past exams that no one asked questions on that, and why waste their time studying for one when they could spend their time on another KSAP, and that's what they did. So not studying essential material might be a reasonable pathway for a candidate to get promoted. So in terms of research needed, I think that we need better guidelines for determining the number of items. We need to consider reliability and the scope of subject matter. And I think that SIOP could help. It could author a white paper on test development that would give us some guidance in this. With respect to immediate action, I think we should consider scope in setting number of items, and we should have a reliable measure on each KSAP. Topic five, written scenarios mimic the job. Many multiple choice items test memory of facts rather than practical application. But let's say the question tested, what information must be reviewed by a sergeant before approving a subordinate's arrest report? Well, if you know the topic, that doesn't mean that you can actually review the report and do an evaluation. Knowing the topic doesn't know that you can use it. So situational items try to get a practical application of knowledges, and they try to reflect the job duties more carefully. Okay, written scenarios give candidates all the important information. On the job, information has to be sought out by the incumbent, and the responses have to be generated, not recognized. So, for example, number two, you observe an officer becoming overly focused on one suspect while ignoring potential nearby threats. Well, and then, you know, what would you do? But the observation is spelled out. In real life, a sergeant might not notice the ignored threats. So in the past, there's been high cost and a long time to develop these items, but it's becoming easier. Gen AI can help create video items, and there have been a number of sessions in this conference that talked about that. But one of the issues we still have is how to evaluate the similarity of a simulation to the job, and how to evaluate the quality of video items beside, gee, it looks good to me. So I think SIOP could try to lead the way in video item development. I think SIOP could create an award for students who develop video items with Gen AI. And I think we could have a Gen AI situational item workshop at next year's conference. The sessions this year don't get into how to do it. They say, this is what we did. Well, that's nice, but I think it would be a nice topic for a pre-conference workshop. Okay, topic six. Higher greater reliability is very nice. You give your situational exercise, you have your raters, they have high rater reliability, and we say that's great, we're happy, we've done it. But there's some new data I've run across, which rated situational exercise by two independent panels using bars, and the inter-rater reliability is reasonably high for the individual panels. But when you correlated the scores of the two panels, the reliability faded. So it went from 0.86 and 0.90 to 0.48. So actually I had a poster on that this morning, and I hope to give another presentation at the International Personnel Assessment Council conference in mid-July on presenting more data on that. The low correlation between panels suggests that neither panel is very valid. We should no longer accept high panel within panel agreement as a good indication that the panel is accurate. Looking at the Venn diagram showing the variance of the panel ratings as they relate to validity, 0.48 is A plus D. It's not just A which is valid. D is the shared invalid. So the 0.48 isn't even 4.48. And the other possible validity in the panels, the B and the C, are probably small because the panels were trained together. We need more research on grading by SMEs using bars. Why do trained panels differ in grading? And can the panels articulate the reasons for their large differences in grading? And I'm working on some of this now. What's causing these differences? Are these differences due to the areas that are being evaluated, the dimensions being evaluated? Are they due to the anchors? Are they due to something else? I wish I knew. But we must now anticipate that the grading panels might be using their own idiosyncratic grading criteria. We need to grade some or all candidates by two panels. We need to look at between panel agreement better. We need to follow up on disparate ratings of panels. Ideally, we would grade all candidates twice until we figure out what's going on and fix it.
What happened?
I should be on. Okay, topic seven. If you quote sources, so in public safety exams in particular, many items, promotional exams, many items quote the wording of the source material that the candidates study. It might be a textbook, it might be a police department standard operating procedure, and often the questions use the exact wording from the sources. And why might they use the exact wording from the sources? Because in many jurisdictions, the candidates have appeal rights, and the appeal rights are heard by a review body. The review body is a lay body, and it's sometimes biased in favor of the test takers, but it also is usually very deferent to a verbatim quote from a textbook. The textbook says this, the question says this, well, you know, that's what it says. The issue is that those quote items often test rote memory rather than application of the knowledge. And they often test definitions, but knowing a definition doesn't mean that you can use the concept that's involved. Another issue is that the wording, the source wording, is often unclear when you take it out of context. So the correct answer that made sense if you read the whole page doesn't necessarily quite fit the item with the quote. And courts are not impressed with rote memory items. Of course, recent court cases have been lost due to that. Courts would like to see the items reflect what's done on the job. So a question that says, what's the most severe action you could take, is not as good as what action should you take? Well, the reference material might support the most severe action you could take, but it might not tell you the correct action to take. Candidates are not going to be happy if you deviate from the source material. And we need to respect the needs of the applicants, that the applicants want to study for the promotional material. The textbook doesn't tell you how to apply everything. You have your textbook in leadership. It tells you, you know, what's important in leadership. Doesn't tell you how to do it, and doesn't tell you how to do it in a specific situation. It might be a college textbook, so we might need different source material that doesn't yet exist. But that's a topic for another discussion. How can we defend keys when we're applying source material to a new situation? And will SMEs agree on a key? Another question is, what's the ideal balance between fluid and crystallized questions, things on memorization and application? With respect to immediate action, I think each exam should contain a certain proportion of questions, both types, on understanding and application. And I think that the job analysis perhaps should be modified to ask about the proportion. I think that if the test asks for application and they're not in the sources, perhaps we could deal with that by having the departments offer promotional training courses where they actually teach people what they're supposed to be doing. In most police departments in the country, police sergeants are expected to learn how to supervise by themselves. They're not given any training beforehand, before the exam. They take the exam, they're promoted. They're not given any training after the exam. I don't think that's an ideal approach. So with respect to the situational items, I think we should be using them. We should deal with the problem that they're not in the textbook. It could be dealt with by having the Civil Service Commission or some other body issue a rule that if the test development SMEs, some number of test development SMEs agree, that will be accepted as sufficient justification for the item. Topic 8. Users of tests assume that if you hire from the top, people will do well on the job, and that the test will identify the best candidates even if the applicants are a mixed bag. So let's look at a plausible scenario. Let's say the validity is 0.3. Let's say that 50% of the applicants can do the job and the top 10% are hired. You could evaluate this using a Monte Carlo study. How many people have a good idea of what a Monte Carlo study is? Okay, in short, doing a Monte Carlo study, you generate hypothetical people with test scores and known test scores and known job performance and a specified relationship between the two called validity, and use that approach when it's hard to evaluate the situation using equations. So a Monte Carlo study shows that 29% of the people hired can't do the job. So since it's hard to fire people, those 29% might be around for a long time. And since we know the job performance of all applicants, we could take a look at the people who are hired in the top 10%. Only 1/5 of the hires are in the top 10% of job performance. Most of the people who are in the top 10% of job performance aren't hired. And 3% of the people who are hired are in the bottom 10% of job performance. And one issue is that we often have validity less than 0.3, so things would be even worse. We also, as another issue, often we ignore some critical knowledge of skills and abilities. Another issue is that sometimes we have small number of candidates. So you might only have one person passing. That one person passing might not score very high. So you're not, the top of the list might not be very high up on the scale. We need more valid tests, better test development, better content. We need proved predictive validity, more test development research. We should push for criterion-related validity studies whenever they're feasible. I think SIOP should lobby Congress for funding for selection research. Grad students might get involved if there was more university business partnerships. Okay, topic 9. Tests have sufficient validity. We routinely rely on tests that explain less than 10% of the job performance variance. We know that the tests aren't perfect, but are they good enough to use? Well, there are many issues. One is that the validity that we find with our validity studies is often higher for training than for job performance. Validity coefficient can change with time. The level of validity varies by the job and the test. There are many false positives and false negatives. And there's a higher false negative rate for minorities. That's not a unsupported position. The joint standards two editions ago said exactly that, and the citation's on the website. Now, reliability caps validity. And we usually look at internal consistency, reliability. Well, actually, test-retest reliability is a better measure of test reliability. So I compiled some test-retest reliability statistics. For performance tests, it was below 0.3 or below. For job knowledge multiple choice tests, it was 0.48. If you ran an internal consistency, it probably would have been 0.9. For situational judgment tests given 1 week apart, it was 0.66. Validity could be no higher than the square root of reliability. I think that another issue is that content and criterion validity are not identical. The validity generalization work we do is based on criterion-related studies. Criterion-related studies are done with large sample sizes. Large sample sizes probably imply large budgets. Large budgets probably imply test development was still done well. Well, what about when you have content validity alone and don't have large budgets? Is that content validity going to be similar to the criterion-related validity? And there was a project done in the military called Project A that found that verbal and quantitative ability had negative weights for vehicle mechanic. Well, no content study is going to tell you that abilities have negative weights. And some managers and applicants really hate tests because of false positives and negatives. And we could do a little thought experiment. If you have an R of 0.3, the relationship between job performance and test performance is a fat ellipse. And if you draw a cut point on the X and Y axis, there'll be a lot of that fat ellipse in the sections that are false positives and false negatives. So false positives and false negatives are unavoidable with validities that we have. So I think that we should not be complacent. We shouldn't say, well, it's good enough. We shouldn't oversimplify this topic. We really need to improve validity. There were some recent journal articles by Paul Sackett and others that hopefully will spawn renewed research on test areas and test methods. I think that we need targeted validity generalization studies. I know of no VG study that looks at promotion. I think we should temper our claims for broad validity generalization, particularly for situations that have not been studied, such as promotions. And as to reliability, we should not rely exclusively on internal consistency validity. Okay, topic 10. Our tests are fair. Well, this is a widespread view, and it's very comforting, particularly when the media start complaining about test fairness. But how many people are familiar with both Thorndike and Cleary definitions of test fairness? So Thorndike said the test fairness would mean that the selection rate is equal among equally qualified candidates, no matter what group they belong to. Sounds pretty good. Cleary said the groups it's fair if the regression lines have the same slope and intercept. But, and among qualified candidates, the selection rate will be smaller for the lower scoring group. So that last statement derives from the fact that the black-white difference in test performance is twice the size as the black-white difference in job performance. So Cleary is asking a question. I'm not sure it's the right question, but our profession prefers the Cleary definition. and it focuses more on the test itself. The Thorndike definition focuses more on the outcomes of the test. But if you were evaluating a drug, would you focus on how it acts or on how well it cures? Okay, so that the black-white mean difference on test score is twice the size as the job performance difference seems on its face unfair. And I would not like to be the expert in court trying to defend that position. Why should be a greater difference in test score than in job performance if you're trying to predict job performance? And it's worse than that. Let's assume that we use the Cleary definition. Well, the Cleary definition assumes a fair criterion. Well, we have good indication that our job criterion are often biased. Men are paid more than women, tall people are paid more than short people, attractive people of both genders are paid more than homely people. These are disturbing indications that the work criteria are biased. So if we are accurately predicting bias criteria, does that mean our tests are biased? So the Cleary definition favors the testing profession that accepted it, but I don't know what position a court would accept. I think the Thorndike definition is more intuitive. I think that we should have renewed focus on research on the focused on definitions of test fairness, and I think that PSYOP could take the lead in doing that type of a review. And I see renewed interest in the definition of test validity on the horizon for another reason. Machine learning is now being subject to a lot of attention with respect to fairness, and they're coming up with their own methods of evaluating the machine learning. Their methods focus on equalized odds and predictive parity. It sounds a lot like Thorndike. So I think we should be considering more than one definition if we evaluate the test with multiple definitions and we look bad under some of them. We should not be the last to know. We should know about it upfront and be able to deal with it. Okay, topic 11. Job analysis to outline is easy. If we have the task in the KSAP list, it'll turn into a clear test blueprint or test outline. We glibly say this, and okay, so until we get the thing, I'll tell you what they say. So the task in KSAPs that we list as the result in our job analysis are described by short phrases. And those short phrases are inadequate for us to use, and they were inadequate for the SMEs to rate. How do you use knowledge of state and federal law when you're developing a test? What state law? Which federal law? And if you're an SME rating that, what are you rating? Issue 2, KSAPs vary in scope, and if we use an equal item count for equally important KSAPs, we might be ignoring those scope differences. In public safety promotional exams, we often have not only tasks and KSAPs, but we have the sources and the reading list. Well, if you rate all three of them, and the tasks and the KSAPs don't necessarily nest within the sources. So how do you use a 2 or 3 way test outline? It gets unwieldy. And sometimes you find the test analysis findings are illogical. I found one that said that sergeants bring officers up on charges daily. Well, they might do it yearly, but daily, absolutely not. There was another one where a management job used budgeting spreadsheets, but didn't require any math ability. And sometimes you find considerable disagreement between SMEs, with some SMEs giving the highest ratings and some SMEs giving the lowest ratings. Is an average a good way of representing that bimodal distribution? And the whole test development process presumes that there's one ideal set of KSAPs. Well, first, different people might do the job differently. So when I was told that when women take the ladders off the fire truck, they go over to it, put it on the shoulder, and run off. And the men go over to it, grab it like this, pull it over the head, and go run off. And if you look at any professional teams, not every player on the team has the same set of skills. So there are a number of unaddressed or unresolved issues. Some are related to the imprecise wording. I think that we need to develop guidelines for what is, that worked, and what size of KSAP is a reasonable size to have an SME to rate and us use and test outline. What's the proper way, the best way to use these multiple ratings we have? And what should we do with rater disagreement? And how do we fix these illogical job analysis results? And how do we measure the interchangeability of KSAPs? So we need a lot of research. And related to that, how do we determine the degree of KSAPs needed or desirable? And are we selecting people to be a team or a individual player? In terms of immediate action, I think that before collecting job analysis data, we should know how we will use the job analysis data to develop the test outline. And we should define the KSAPs precisely enough so we can do that. So, it's 4:53. Skip ahead. We focus on validity. We design tests based on validity. It seems so logical. Why would I be talking about it? Well, managers are only interested in utility. Utility and validity are related, but they're not identical. Utility is a function of three things: validity, quality of applicants, and selection ratio. So if the validity is zero, you might still hire superstars if all your applicants are superstars. And so the quality of candidates is very important. It looks like our next troop is moving in. So, thank you very much. It's a pleasure chatting with you. And if anybody wants to chat about it more, let me know.